U.S. weapons, on U.S. maintaining and repairing of their aircraft, on U.S. Mid-air refueling, and on U.S. targeting assistance. We know that they cannot continue to wage war in Yemen without extensive U.S. Assistance, and Congress really needs to act quickly to continue to introduce resolutions in the Senate and in the House to push the U.S. out of Yemen.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Shireen Al-Adhemi is a Yemeni scholar, activist, and assistant professor now at Michigan State University, speaking to us from East Lansing. And Maggie Michelle, AP reporter, speaking to us from Cairo, Egypt. This is Democracy Now! We have a Democracy Now! Full-time job opening for a broadcast engineer here in our New York City studio. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massou, Trina Nadur, Nat Need, and Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock. Coming up this morning on KBOO, next on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, they cover politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9 on Alternative Radio, journalist and author Chris Hedges connects the dangers of extraction industries and sexploitation. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D-May and Susanna Mars welcome actress, comedian, and activist Margaret Cho, who returns to Portland with her Fresh Off the Boat tour. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, they talk to Glenn Clevenger and Ann Hamilton about their paintings and sculptures on view now in Portland. Today in Portland, we can expect a hot day with unhealthful air quality due to smoke from regional wildfires. Temperatures will reach the high 90s. KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. The Finance Committee meets this month on August 23rd at Cider Riot at 807 North East Cooch.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
Hey, good morning. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is a smoky, deadly day. Thank God that there's no global warming. Abe Proctor is not here. I am. Call me, 231-8187. Talk to the world, or at least part of it. I got a lot of stuff to deal with today, and I think it's worth talking about. Some of it, maybe not all of it. First of all, it's interesting to read in the New York Times, that the U.S. government is opposing a peace treaty between the two Koreas. This is amazing. This is possibly none of the U.S.'s business, so we have a lot of troops there, and North Korea evidently has nuclear weapons deliverable by guided missiles. However, It is a really an interesting phenomenon to actually have the government admitting its role as an imperial power in Korea. If you remember, or if you have read a book, you will recall that the Korean War ended in a stalemate, a truce, negotiated by the Eisenhower administration way back when, and that things have been in that situation for a long, long time. It has forced because of the dictatorship in the North and because of the dictatorship, and this is something we forget, in the South under Syngman Rhee, our guy, it has been the case that Korea has been split in half arbitrarily, approximately where the old 38th parallel was. And just so you have a historical perspective, remember that the United States armies, led by Douglas MacArthur, General MacArthur, great hero of the Philippines, blah, 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 went into Korea, one of the brilliant maneuvers of that war when the South Korean armies and the Americans were at a point of losing and barely at the tip of South Korea, and made a landing at Incheon and fought their way up to the 38th parallel. If they had stopped there, it would have been an incredible victory, and it would have established in the minds of both the Soviets and the fledgling communist regime in China, it would have established that the United States would fight and defend territories in the American, as it were, bloc. But MacArthur, under the influence of something called the China Lobby, which was Senator Noland and many others of that time, wanted to use that as an opportunity to defeat the then brand new, as of 49, the brand new government of China and, of course, of the Soviet Union. And he did. He moved, or he did try. He moved northward steadily, very successful campaign. Seemingly the enemy faded away. And then came warnings from China and from the Soviet Union that, hey, you know, you keep moving north and looking like you're going to invade, we're going to respond. And what the Chinese did was put their then very tactically brilliant and powerful army into the field and come down the mountainous center of Korea and suddenly appeared. The Americans were driven back and finally rallied and were able to maintain the border at approximately the 38th parallel with no victory in sight. This became a very major item that brought Eisenhower, who said, I will go to Korea, into the presidency. It was a major force in that because the stalemate was so undesirable by many, many, many Americans. Since that time, the Syngman Rhee regime collapsed. South Korea is a traditional democracy. North Korea is an absolute dictatorship. And North Korea has developed nuclear weapons thanks to a fellow named Khan, who gave away the secret of developing cheaply nuclear fuel for bombs. As a result of all of that, we the Americans, face the very real danger that the Kim regime, remember, a dictatorship unto itself of three generations, a very real danger of a war, an attack from that country, not a sustained disaster, but something that could do a great deal of harm in the world and to us. So that's the situation there. It's kind of an interesting one. It is also the case that more and more evidence seems to mount that we have an administration in Washington at this time that is led by a man who cannot keep track of what he says, who forgets, who lies all the time. This is the first most important point. Lies all the time. How to tell when Trump is lying? He's talking. He lies all the time. He makes stuff up. He creates contradictory information. He invents stuff. He's supported by a bunch of liars himself. And in the end, I don't think he or his people keep much of a track of what he has said. The result of all of this is an unsettling sense that this is not a mature individual, and an unsettling sense that he has no sense of the global or even local conditions under which the United States exists. As a result of all of that, we really are looking at a very frightening situation. One of the things Trump said famously at the beginning of his questionable presidency, why do we have nuclear weapons if we can't use them? And indeed, we're developing smaller tactical nuclear weapons even as we speak. It's a very scary situation. And part of the scariness of it is that a huge number of Americans really do believe that somehow Trump is just the right cure for the situation the U.S. is in. And that is, I think, driven largely by fear of people of color. A frightening sense that the country is changing, which it is. I would point out that if, in fact, the attitudes of the Trump administration were applied to people coming to the U.S. after World War II, they would not be allowed in. And these were Europeans and the good Asians. I mean, this is really a very sad and sick situation. I welcome you to call in, but I'm not going to devote much time to this. By the way, Abe isn't here today, so I'm kind of winging it on my own. But I'd love to hear from you. 231-8187. Do we have a caller? Hey, Dougie.
Yeah.
How are you?
Hey, is this Joe?
It is.
Hey, Joe. One of the reasons that I listen to you, your show is I like your attitude. You have a good sense of humor, and what's funny is that little bit of sarcasm that's kind of always in your voice. but
thank you. I guess go ahead.
but the reason I called today is I don't know if you read that article that's been out for the past few days where Earth could start hitting these tipping points where we could go into a hot Earth.
Yeah, I mean, I know the material. I don't know which specific article you're referring to, but there's increasing evidence that we're at a crisis in terms of climate.
Yeah, we got about basically between 10 and 20 years to drastically reduce our emissions, or we could have a hothouse Earth where we could go over tipping points, whether it be the rapid permafrost melting or cap rates being released from the ocean floor, the destruction of the rainforest, coral bleaching, all these different things that it could lead to a domino effect where even besides the emissions that we have from the fossil fuel industry, the Earth could warm up 5 degrees Celsius, 7 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit on top of the fossil fuel, which would be completely catastrophic because all the water will melt and all the coastlines will be flooded. We'll have rampant drought around the planet and massive climate refugees. So this kind of thing sometimes is depressing. And we have Donald Trump. Our government has been taken over by ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers. You still have a large amount of the population that still is just acting as if they're not even acknowledging climate change. And then we have the possibility of, you know, Donald Trump and his administration sabotaging North and South Korea, going against the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, how do you think this is all going to turn out?
How do I think it's going to turn out? Well, I have a very dark view of human behavior in general, and I have a very, very dark view of American capitalism.
Are we going to pull out of it? Are we going to be able to make it out of this? I mean,
I have no idea. I don't know. I have a dark view. I have children. They have children. You know, it's something in which I have a certain level of investment beyond the intellectual. But I don't know the answer. I think we're in a whole, I'm trying to think of a word I can use on the air, a whole bunch of trouble. And I think that the denial that we see pushed largely by the fossil fuel industry is very, very serious. Even if we turned our attention now to dealing with these issues, I'm not sure we have enough science knowledge, and I'm not sure we have enough willpower, and I'm certainly not sure we have enough capital to change our economic system. There are two things I think need to happen, since you asked. The first is a change in our politics. We don't want to turn to some totalitarian regime. but we do need to turn to some form of social democracy that allows for the basic needs of human beings, rich or poor, to have their needs met by the government, because why have a government if not having that? That's number one. Number two, we do need policies, absolutely policies that acknowledge the incredible disasters we face. What's really interesting right now is you go outside, anywhere, almost anywhere where there's smoke and there's heat, and there didn't used to be that much smoke or that much heat, and you see, hey, if this ain't climate change, what is? The tundra is melting, which produces an incredible amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the melting of the polar ice caps. All of this points to, the as you suggested, the destruction of our coastlines. It's all real. And one of the things that happens in all of this is a human kind of tragedy. People have to move. They leave the flooded areas, they leave the dry areas, and they push their way into places that are more desirable to live in. That kind of a crisis is an enormously scary thing. It ends up in wars and other kinds of structural damage. And that in the face of all of the physical destruction, hey, I don't know, but I do know this. I do know that we all need to unite. And in fact, I'm going to use your call as an opportunity to say something, because I think I need to say this. The first thing I need to say is a kind of an apology. I think I have become, as a grumpy old man, too critical of various forces on the left. I don't know what works best. I do know that the Antifa movement, which I was very critical about specific Black Bloc activities, is, you know, the criticism valid, but the fact of the matter is the larger issue of the Antifa struggle, the anti-fascist struggle, is very important. It has had enormous effect. It is a good thing. What we all need to do right now, regardless of our individual niche in the political descent, we all need to pay attention to what's going on, and we all need to support each other. That means what used to be called, back ironically in the 1930s, a united front against fascism. So I think my criticisms of various activities of the Black Bloc or others are stupid, really. In light of the situation we're in, I think I've been very wrong. I think what I cannot say what will work or what won't work under these conditions. I can only say that struggle is important, that it's ethically necessary. My support of nonviolence is based on the effectiveness of it in previous times. I am not. Let me finish. I'm not advocating violence. I am advocating a united front of various elements. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, and I won't keep you long because I know you got other callers. But I agree with your perspective. You know, as I've gotten older, when I was younger, I was. You know, I supported the possibility of violent revolutions against, you know, these people. But I think as I've gotten older, the violence that's the whole problem. Violence doesn't necessarily solve the violence. It just perpetuates more violence. And maybe it's just because I've gotten older, but I do respect you know, the example of Dr. King and of Gandhi, and that we need more peace in the world. It's not a good example. You have to use violence, but sometimes violence is necessary. I'm thankful that when people went to D.C., that there were only 20 or 30 Nazis that showed up and thousands of anti-fascists. That's a beautiful sign. But the last thing that I wanted to say, Joe, is that there was a report that came from Common Dreams that said that, you know, I was excited about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and DSA, but now the Democrats, led by Perez, are now going to accept money from the fossil fuel industry. I don't know if you heard that.
I did hear that, and it is very disturbing. I think there needs to be a break, a clear break, between, if the party of the liberal causes is to be the Democrats, a clear break from the business as usual capitalist drive toward fascism.
And accepting money from the people who are destroying the planet. I mean, don't.
I agree with you. I see the irony of it, and I'm certainly against it. I know that it is expensive and dangerous to walk away from money when you're running campaigns on a national scale. However,
yeah.
I think it's necessary. I think it's time we, all of us, said, hey, this is enough of this nonsense. We want a system that allows for people to make money, but that supports the needs of every person in the world, and certainly in America.
I just hope it doesn't turn some people off to, you know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think if you're asking, does it turn people off to have the Democratic Party swallowing the monies of the problem makers rather than the problem addressers? Yeah, I think that's a big mistake. I think it's time that since we have this two-party system, which is sort of weird in of itself in democracies, it's time for the almost left party to be a left party and to be critical and to actually authentically take the risks that are necessary to produce a true democracy. That's where
I'm at. Just as quick as they were able to vote down that resolution and reverse it, if the people demand that they don't accept that money, then there's a possibility that they can reverse that. You know, that's my hope.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know the politics of the Democrats very well. I know that there has long been, and I think Hillary Clinton was an unfortunate example of that, a tendency to drive toward the middle and to muddle. The middle is muddled because of the desire not to alienate the moneyed class. And I think that's ridiculous. I think we have to acknowledge that it's up to all of us to struggle to make a more just society. And I think it's up to us, all of us, to acknowledge that while we may have many differences among those who are our supporters or possible supporters, that it's more important at this point in history to struggle against fascism than it is to have internecine arguments.
That's why I'm saying,
look, I may disagree with some techniques that are used, but I'm wrong. It doesn't matter. What really matters now is that every way of fighting fascism should be tried. And that's, I just want to say that.
I agree. I mean, because there is the possibility that it could grow and get worse, but it's great that in D.C., that only like 20 or 30 fascists showed up and there were thousands. I mean, that just shows that since Charlottesville, I mean, some of those people were, I think they realized that, hey, you know, we came here about this statue and this woman got killed and maybe this ain't, you know, I didn't come here for people to end up getting ran over by.
Well, I don't know personally why it was that there was such a small crowd of fascists. I do know that the horror of Charlottesville had to strike anyone with any conscience. And I think that also it's an odd uniting of Klan-oriented people, romanticizers of the Confederacy, Nazis, neo-Nazis, various right-wing groups, and that it is an uneasy alliance by its very nature. So maybe it simply fell apart. I also think that the murder that took place in Charlottesville and the behavior of the president saying, oh, it was both sides, right? That also galvanized opinion. And I also believe ardently that there is a certain level of decency that many people have, whether their politics are right or left. And I think that the Charlottesville marching with the torches and the anti-Semitism and the anti-black expression and all of that turns people off ultimately. And I also kind of believe that Americans are smarter than that. So maybe the fascist thing has run its course for right now, at least. Maybe.
Well, what do you think is up with the far right and how they're so, you know, we're facing catastrophic climate change and, you know, possible extinction of, you know, all the different species on the planet. I know that they're inspired by the fossil fuel industry and they believe in climate denialism, I think, but isn't it crazy that they think that their agenda of white superiority and keeping Mexicans out of the country is more of a priority than saving the future of the planet?
It's crazy, but remember that this nation was founded on assumptions of racism, that we live in a country that enshrined slavery as part of a deal to make a nation, that we slaughtered the indigenous peoples whose cultures were very interesting and very worthy of survival. We are not a righteous people in that sense. The Civil War seems to be unendingly fought. You know, these are things that need to be addressed along with the other basic needs. We need to have a decent healthcare system. We need to have a decent housing structure. We need to have a decent system of infrastructure, particularly high-speed rail. All these things need to be done. They are happening to some degree in many parts of Europe. They're not happening at all here. Whether or not we can, as a people, recognize these needs and rally to them. I'm going to let you go because I want other people to have a chance.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
But I appreciate the call. I also want to make a point here that's really important. And I think I've referred to this in the past. When I was teaching many, many years ago at Clackamas Community College, where there is, in Clackamas County, a large population of people who believe in fundamentalist Christianity of various sorts, I discovered in a class, as a peripheral issue, a sociology class actually, that a student asked me, well, what if we find something in the book that's wrong? I don't know if I'm repeating a story that maybe is boring, but I'll make it quick. And I said, well, what was wrong in the book? I said, you know, the book can be wrong. Books can be wrong. And he said, well, it says in here that there are humanoids for, I can't remember, lots of years. And I said, and that's, what's the problem? He said, well, the entire universe is only 6,000 years old. So that was a stumbler. And then I actually spent a little time talking about the red shift and how all the stars in the universe are moving away from each other, how this, in other words, an expanding universe, how the speed is enormous and the time is enormous, and that nobody in the classroom understood what a light year, for example, was, and that basically, of course, the Bible's, and by the way, this is not strictly speaking Bible, but the measurements, I think it was the Bishop of Usher, the assumptions about how long there's been a human population, in fact, how long there's been an Earth, are not scientific. It's a religious statement. I've noted, I think, that various religions have abandoned that position because it's really wrong to hold an idea that is not true. Anyway, all of that, after all of that conversation, I was unpersuasive. The majority of the students in that classroom, about 60% of them, I think it was 30-odd students in that room, all still believed in a biblically based, because it's not in the Bible, 6,000-year extension of humankind, of in fact the universe. So I don't know. I don't know what you do in a world of mythological things. I have a neighbor, for example, who believes in fairies, not the insulting term for gay people, but, you know, the flying cute creatures and elves and woodland fauns and so on. Well, you know, that stuff is charming, but it is also dangerous because it doesn't deal with anything that we know to be a reality. So I don't know how you get past that. I don't know how you argue it. If people hold religious beliefs that you find untenable, is it appropriate to attack those religious beliefs? Is it necessary to attack them? Is it possible to have, which I think we see in other places, a coexistence of science and religion? I don't know. I know that time is running out. I know that the air is getting to be very hard to breathe right here in Portland, Oregon. And I can see that the current administration is on a death march. And the leader of it is a psychotic. So, who knows? Anyway, we've got callers. Charlotte, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just trying to call with my response to some of the previous discussion. My first comment is that I'm an idealist. I think people have to be idealists. I think if they want to have a better life for themselves, for the people in their country, for global citizens, we have to see in an educated and both historically and in current factual world we live in, we have to figure out ways to act to try to make life better for everybody, for their common everyday lives, which includes, therefore, politics and a lot of bigger issues that we have to engage in. Things might look bad, things might be very bad, but we have to take an existential leap to make a decision to have an ethical life and to try to make life better. And unfortunately, it's necessary to, in every world at every time, to have that in one's mind, because steps forward can also be taken away. And there just needs to be constant engagement in our own lives and in the lives of our fellow citizens here and in the world. And in order to do that, one has to maintain one's ideals, work for one's ideals, but one also has to be pragmatic. One has to deal with the facts on the ground and also prioritize at any given time what is most important to do. And all of this is leading up to the fact that you can talk about fascism in terms of movements here, but you can also talk in terms of what's happening in our government now, when we have somebody who is totally authoritarianly based, disregarding and attacking the rule of law, attacking any kind of systems that are contrary to the authoritarian ruler's desires, both in our own country and in the world. So if you want to be anti-fascist, if you want to actually make a better life for everyone in this country and in the world, and a better life in terms of just the rule of law, which is a very important thing, to have a system that actually supports people's lives individually, I think that we have to unite to fight fascism by also making a decision to not choose in our election, in this election and elections coming up. We have to make decisions that are prioritized to fight the largest danger at any given time, meaning that we have to, for example, be very unhappy about the fact that the Democrats at the DNC, not the Democrats in the country, not necessarily all the Democrats that are in political office and ones that we might vote for, that they have made this decision to take money from carbon fuel companies. But the Democrats are the only option right now to take back the country, have some kind of control for everybody's needs, for a better life for everybody on a daily basis, and going forward to try to make any change. That's just the reality on the ground. So that's my basic position and comment on the subjects that you've talked about so far.
Okay, thank you for the call. I want to get some other folks on the air, give them the opportunity. You know, one of the things that has always disappointed me about KBOO Radio is that it speaks to a relatively narrow and, ironically, educated audience of willfully left-wing people, for the most part. I don't try to discourage, although I do certainly criticize, right-wing talkers calling in and so on. But we all have more or less a discussion that is rooted in a critical theory of American history and American situation. And I think that's important. I think it's a role that's essential, and I'm glad KBOO exists to do that. And by the way, if you have not given a whole bunch of money, whatever you can afford, to this station, you really should do that now, because this is the only, as far as I know, the only really active on-air radio opposing fascism and making noise in favor of a popular front against fascism. And as I said earlier, I really feel that I should be and can be criticized for being too hard on those who are using other methods to oppose the Nazification of America. And it doesn't make any sense at this point to be that kind of a critic, to be such a purist. I'm not giving up my belief in nonviolence, but I am saying that there are many paths to opposing fascism. And I'll let that go. Let's go to our next caller. Jack, you're on the air.
Yes, you talked about your experience teaching fundamentalists.
Yes.
And in the same conversation, you referred to your neighbor who has a fascination with fairies and elves and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that brought up in my mind, it caused me to recall what I usually say to Christians who come, and I'm sure they come to your door too. They come on their mission, proselytizing, as it were. Everybody's encountered them. Typically, I just remind them that, you know, actually, what you've got here is a serviceable as any other mythology. This is what I'm hearing from you, a mythology that's, you know, the Christian mythology is as good as the pagan mythologies that support the elves and fairies and so forth, and have at it, you know, but I'm not subscribing, and, you know, have a nice day. So that's, I think, to remind them that, you know, basically you've got a nice little mythology here. You know, enjoy it, but probably a lot of others are not going to join you. And that's I think a fairly honest and respectful way of handling it.
Well, I thank you for the call. I'm going to end this conversation with you. I don't disagree with you. I think that tolerance is very important. However, I think that the concretization of reality, the for example, the reality of global climate change is undeniable at this point. In fact, from what I understand, the changes in sea level and the changes in temperature and the changes in fires and other phenomena that's happening right now is several years in advance of what was predicted by climate change scientists. So it's moving faster than we thought. The need to change things is very, very real. We don't have a government that has in any sense shown response adequate to the situation, and I doubt that it will. I think we're in for some very hard times. Meanwhile, all of the things that I had assumed would be the case by now, after many years of worrying and struggling and so on, they're not happening. We should have had, and we still need to have, a national health care system. Most of the industrialized capitalist world, in fact, just about all of it, has that in one form or another, and I did a study for the Kaiser Research Foundation way back in the 70s, early 70s, looking at Denmark and looking at Holland, and then also looking at the then Yugoslavian government, and discovered that in all three cases, less so in Yugoslavia, but certainly in the case of the two capitalist countries, Holland, the center traditionally of intellectual capitalism, and in Denmark, the healthcare system was excellent. And it was fair, and it was something you got with the process of being a citizen. I think this is something that should have happened a long time ago, and it should happen now. I also think that we need to have a high-speed rail system. Why? Because taking aeroplanes everywhere is a damage to the environment, a serious damage to the air. And it is an indulgence that reflects wealth and inequality in and of itself. There are various things that are like that, and I think that in order for that to happen, we really need to have a cogent, serious struggle with a party that is, I will call it left, for lack of a better term, that is the Popular Front Left Party. And I think that at this point in our history, it's going to have to come out of the Democrats. It discourages me when they decide to take money because they need money for their advertising. They decide to take money from the very people who are the destroyers. Anyway, let's get some more callers. 231-8187. Who do we got? Jane, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm sorry. I had a comment about fossil fuel and the Antifa. My thing about them is that they don't really know their business facts. and I can hear it when people start talking. And I mean, I don't know everything, but I can hear some of the stuff that people don't know about, like Japan is the number one user of liquefied natural gas in the world because of Fukushima. And it, like, I heard the ambassador, he was almost in tears, like, because of that. You know, but it's a big deal, and that's something to consider that people aren't talking about. And it's like, I mean, I could go endlessly about business. Like, I don't know if Chris Hedges is going to talk about mining. Like, East India, you know, like, they get their uranium from Cigar Lake. That's tribal lands in Canada. Mm-hmm. And these are things that people don't consider. They don't consider that East Indian women like to buy gold jewelry. Gold is a heavy polluter. It doesn't come from Switzerland in the golden forest next to the Chocolate River. It comes from Ghana. And
hey, I like the Chocolate River. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I'm sorry. Like, I mean, my whole thing is that once you start, okay, you know, actually, this has been on my mind since I've heard people talking. I worked in business reports. I'm not a journalist. I'm a regular person, but it's like I worked for a dude who was a top level oil rig designer. He wasn't white. He was Chinese. I loved him. He was a great man. He's an awesome person, but he wasn't white. And yet we're constantly going like it's the white dude. And that's something that I just wish people would have in their minds about the rest of the world. I'm not a writer, and I just thought I'd throw that in. I can't say I'm not a fan. The neo-Nazi thing is like with the KKK, it doesn't look right. I mean, that obviously doesn't look right either. But the whole business thing, it just I just thought I'd bring up those points. I don't know what else to say. That's all I had.
Well, thanks for the call. And I think much of what you said is important. I don't think that there is a linkage, except economically, between peoples and capitalism. I don't think there are bad Asians or good Asians or bad Africans or good Africans or bad North Americans or good North Americans. I think we're all, unfortunately, trapped in a system which has brought a lot of positive change, but also brought a lot of damage. And I think it's time to re-examine that, and beyond re-examining it, to change things. My solution is kind of limited. I think that at this point, historically, the way the U.S. can get out of where it's at is to change the power structure. But I don't think it's going to be an easy thing to do. And I think that the route to that is to follow a European model of social democracy, at least for the time being. Anyway, I hope to hear from other people on all of this. I'm not trying somehow to come up with a grand scheme of change. The thing I did want to make clear, just because I guess reach a few hundred people or something, is that I really think I need to apologize for my hypercriticism of the Black Bloc and so on. There are issues there. There are things I don't agree with there. But they are active. They are in larger and larger numbers, willing to show up and willing to fight the dangers of the right wing. And whatever criticism I have is nothing compared to the danger that the current popular fascist movement represents in this country and in the world. By the way, the entire Western world and most of the Eastern world, as it were, is moving to the right. And that is extremely scary, not only leading to wars probably, but leading to an inability to deal with major issues like climate change. Let's see what else we got going on. So we're kind of quiet for the moment. I guess I want to talk about a few other things. Recently, we saw that, here's one of the interesting things about Trump. He engages in deniability in every case. He acted like he was really surprised when Amorosa Manigault Newman, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, was fired by his guy. as if he didn't have anything to do with it, which maybe is true, because, you know, it could well be that at this point the administration is not in his hands, but in the hands of more rational right-wingers, although I kind of doubt that. I also believe that when you have a president who always lies, and this is not an exaggeration, by the way, he can't distinguish truth from falsehood, and he can't, and this is really scary, remember what he said day to day. So we have a very incompetent, not only a right-wing government, but a very incompetent government that serves, if it serves anyone, the very wealthy, and is being supported by the very wealthy. This has got to change. And the only way to bring that change about without some kind of weird revolutionary thing is to have a strong, concerned, active voting population. And that's where my head's at right now. The biggest contradiction that I see in American politics is the contradiction between the crazy right-wing government and the needs of the American people. And that's where I think I need to put my energy, and I think you need to put your energy there, too. Anyway, let's go to the phones. 231-8187. Joe.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air, man.
Yeah. Well, I hear folks talking about the clock, and I was just hearing you, kind of the end a lot.
Let me wait a minute. Hold on. You're
picking up a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of your phone is kind of messed up or something, or maybe ours.
Is that?
No, you got. Can you just call back and see if we get a clean line?
I'll call right back. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but that's what's happening. Let's go to Tim. Hey, Tim, you're on the air.
Yeah, Joe. You know, I've been studying the student strike at BSU in 1970.
I remember it well.
Yeah, and your name came up a few different times in the various pieces of research I was doing. I was kind of curious if you could talk about your role in the student strike, and also talk about apparently Wolf, that was the guy's name, the president of PSU.
Yeah, Greg Wolf.
Yeah, apparently he's the one who shut PSU down.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that too, and what got him to do that?
Well, I can do that briefly. It's a long time ago, 1970. Remember that strike was a nationwide student strike. It's weird to have students on strike, although that became a tradition way back, and certainly in 1968 in France, where survivors of that era are called, by the way, 68ers, that is 68ers. What happened was that the National Guard killed a bunch of people in the Midwest for no apparent reason, and a similar thing, which was not adequately covered, happened in a school in the South where African Americans were shot. These events caused an outrage and a sense of desperation. Already there had been a powerful anti-war movement that was being ignored by the establishment. So there was an effort to have this kind of strike, and it worked at Portland State.
Now, wait, when you say it worked, how did you get the president to
I didn't.
Down? Because I know there was pushback that many students didn't want the school to close.
That's true. I have no idea what if you'd had a vote on it, how it would have gone. I do know that Greg Wolf was a traditional liberal and a part of the State Department establishment in his own career in Latin America. I also know that it was the end of his career in Portland State when he seemed to support the strike. I also know that the behavior of the Portland police, which I still see as reprehensible, by the way, was definitely anti-strike, and it resulted in a beatdown in the park blocks, which was the end, really, of the resistance. I think that, I'm trying to remember back to those times.
Were you in the student body at that time?
I was a graduate student, and I was not, I want to make clear, I was not a leader of that movement.
Weren't you at one point in time student body president?
Yeah, back in 66, 67, a long time ago.
Okay.
Yeah, and I probably didn't accomplish that much. The main thing I did accomplish was to bring people like Ginsburg and various leftists, Stokely Carmichael, as he was then known, Timothy Leary, who turned out to be an impious fraud, various people who we brought who were famous people. I also figured out a way to put on dances that would have popularity as opposed to losing money, which created an odd situation where the student government actually had a moment of financial independence. I don't think that was a particularly effective thing. The only thing that it was symbolic. That is that suddenly a guy who came out of the left became the student body president in a system that was traditionally things like smashing cars as a symbolic act of rebellion to support somebody who wanted to do the same stuff as every other president of the student body did. I also don't think the student government at that point had a great deal of power, and the fact that I was able to work with others to build more power in that situation was effective. And I also think that I was kind of a jerk.
The student body association is the one that put up the tent, I think, at the Park Blocks.
I believe so, yeah. You know, I got to say, I was not in a leadership position. So from my point of view,
you led a workshop at the teach-in at Smith Center.
Yeah, I did a nonviolence training there.
Do you remember who else was doing classes and whatnot at that?
I really don't. I remember one of my my teachers, a guy named Gary Waller, a sociologist who was a Marxist, was influential in the sociology department at that point. He did not finish his PhD and was not given tenure. I also know that this was a time of enormous cultural change, social change, on all kinds of levels. This was suddenly, to understand that period, the early 70s, the late 60s, the things you have to remember include the fact that suddenly contraception was available for women. Suddenly there was the availability of psychedelic drugs, and suddenly there was an open discussion of alternatives to capitalism. All of that in the light of the horrible and endless and stupid war in Southeast Asia.
Did you go out to Vortex One when that happened later that year?
No. I had no interest in averting a challenge to the American Legion in Portland, Oregon. I thought Tom McCall was brilliant to have created it, but it was weird, and it was an escapist adventure. By the way, the Vortex thing was surrounded by the National Guard. Had that crowd suddenly decided to go downtown, it would have been stopped.
Oh, they were never planning to go downtown. Have you seen Matt Love's book on Vortex One?
I have not. I know Matt. I haven't read the book though.
Yeah. No, it's it was a giant social experiment, and McCall was very much behind it. And
yeah, I thought McCall's strategy was very bright.
There was a demonstration downtown.
Yeah, there was.
And what was the results down there?
Well, it was weird. The city took the metro buses and had them go ahead of the marchers. The marchers who left from Dunaway Park, as I recall, had amongst them a lot of agents who had been brought in from FBI and other police agencies to mingle with the crowd. They went. They looked raggle-taggle and dangerous and violent. And not really so. And there was a great fear that the town would be trashed. They were having the buses corner to corner, wall to wall, leading the crowd, putting out noxious fumes, and then having them go down and have no specific goal, and then turn around and go back was kind of a weird thing. It was called, by the way, the resistance was called the People's Army Jamboree.
Right, yes, there's a lot about that. The agents that were put in and all the different spies that the FBI had in place and whatnot. It was all going on. So, okay.
Well, it was all very real. It was all very.
What you can.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just thanking you for remembering what you could about those details. There's quite a bit at PSU now, old documents and whatnot. They did a presentation about it, about a year ago. And, for instance, they had all of the letters that were sent to the president demanding that he reopen the campus.
Yeah, I was not, again, I was not in the leadership there. I did make a couple of speeches because I guess I'm...
Who was in the leadership?
Well, look, I'm not going to talk about who was in the leadership. I'm not going to do that. It's not a reveal for me to make. I do think that the group was sincerely radical and radicalized by the Vietnam War and by the civil rights movement. And I do think their intents were very sincere. I said at the time I didn't really understand, and I say this about the French events of 68, how a strike of the students has any real economic impact in the long run. I don't know that I was right. I don't know that I was wrong. I simply think that that was what happened. In the end, and this is important, in the end, very little was changed. People got hurt. The so-called tent, which was really a geodesic dome, didn't get moved, which is what I had advocated, to university land. And it gave an opportunity to the police department under the leadership of a guy named Brulette, who was, I think, then a lieutenant and later became higher up in the police department, who had trained the tactical squad, which is now the standard for all police beatdowns. And he started that here. It was a common problem and a common response all over the United States. And the police attacked and did not arrest anyone at that moving or smashing of that geodesic dome. They simply hurt people, and they wanted revenge because they felt they'd been humiliated consistently during the days of the strike, as far as I could tell.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. That's what I, you know, and again, I was not really...
I mean, I know Frank Geezy, for instance, was part of the teach-in that happened at Smithson. I'm just trying to flesh out, you know...
This is a long time ago, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Frank Geezy was the head of the French department. He was among the very many, well, not many, quite a few people became totally disillusioned, and that heightened their sense of contradiction and their desire to do something. He became a part of a group of people who he had been teaching at the State Pen and who essentially decided they needed to do physical action. One of the things that they did was to blow up, with not really great effect, a couple of recruiting centers, and to make apparently a plot to take leadership and humiliate them and perhaps even hurt them. And all of that was, I think, very foolish. He ended up going to jail, and he ended up not even making what I thought was an adequate defense of his situation. For example, when they seized his books, they showed that he had a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook. Well, it's available. You can get it at probably Powell's. And it was, among many books. I thought that his lawyers should have had his whole library brought down to the federal courthouse and lined up and all the titles read out.
Yeah, I was doing research on Frank. I knew Frank pretty well, and I suddenly realized that he was actually recruiting people out of prison
to carry out
these kind of actions.
Yeah, I don't know if he was recruiting or being recruited. I think he got himself caught in it.
He recruited out of prisons.
Okay, see, and that's something I don't know.
Lynn Meyer was the other guy who took the fall in the ROTC bombing conspiracy case, and I talked with him, and he was talking about Frank's role, and he was recruited out of prison.
Huh. And, yeah, I think that's right. Now, let me be clear about this. Frank is gone.
Yes, Frank has died.
He can't defend himself, and we can't really understand exactly what his motives were at this point. I'm out of time, and I do appreciate your call, although for me, it's a little bit more nostalgia and history than it is action. And
I think it's relevant today in terms of, the actions that, Antifa is taking and, this kind of similar...
Well, I'm not sure that there's a great similarity. As I said earlier in the show, I'm now more supportive of Antifa movements than I had been in past weeks. I think it's unfortunately the case that every path of resistance is important. Anyway, I wish you all well. Stay tuned to KBOO, best in music and the best in public affairs. And I'll see you probably with Abe next week. To the USA.
Tune in on Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Emma Lugo of Transpositive will host this special on-air program. You can join us that night at the Queer Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 31st. More information about the Queer Community Open House and anniversary programming is available at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland. We're available on 90.7 FM at K2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up this morning on KBOO, next at 9 o'clock, an alternative radio journalist and author, Chris Hedges, connects the dangers of extraction industries and sexploitation. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, Dewey May and Susanna Mars welcome actress, comedian, and activist Margaret Cho, who returns to Portland with her Fresh Off the Boat tour. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, they talk to Glenn Clevenger and Ann Hamilton about their paintings and sculptures on view now in Portland. Today we can expect a hot day with unhealthful air quality due to smoke from regional wildfires. Temperatures will reach the high 90s. KBOO programming is made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the August OMSI After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death.